Hello, and welcome to this podcast from the Oxford Institute for Energy Studies.
Welcome to the latest Oxford Institute for Energy Studies podcast. My name is David Ledesma, and I'm a Distinguished Research Fellow at the Institute. It's my great pleasure to be joined today by Dr. Ademir Masurovic, who's Senior Research Fellow at the OAS, and Kurt Chapman, who's the Independent Consultant. And we're here today to discuss the key messages that came from their paper, The Brent Benchmark, Where Do We Stand?, that was published by the Institute at the end of July 2022. I think it's worth noting that this podcast also builds on Addy and Kurt's April 2022 podcast, which we recorded together, The Future of the Brent Oil Benchmark, a Radical Makeover, that's also available on the OIES website, should you wish to listen to it. Now, just to timestamp this podcast in this ever-changing market, we are recording it on the afternoon of Thursday, the 4th of August, 2022. Addy and Kurt, welcome back to the OIS podcast series.
Hi, David. Good to be back.
Yes, David. Thank you for having us again.
Great. Well, okay. Well, Addy, why don't I start with you? The title of the paper is The Brent Benchmark, Where Do We Stand? So can I perhaps start with a very basic question? In general terms, where do we stand? Has the industry reached a consensus on the introduction of WTI Midland crude oil into the Brent benchmark?
Well, David, this sort of summertime seems to be quite appropriate for this discussion because things have gone a little bit quiet, people on holidays. But it seems to me that there is a sort of broad consensus that seemed to have emerged regarding the inclusion of WTI Midland into the Brent benchmark. We have spoken to a number of people in the industry, and it seems that there is a quiet acceptance of the sort of broad general sort of ideas that have been put forward. Now, for example, cargo size being moved from 600 to 700,000 barrels seems to be accepted. The fact that Dated will have WTI Midland in it as a component seems to be fairly straightforward as well. I would like to add that in our last paper and our last podcast, we did suggest, Kurt and I suggested that the freight adjustment factor, or FAF, be changed from the original Platts proposal from 40% to 80%, and I'm glad that they've actually accepted that, which we think made a lot of sense. And what's really left are two things. It's general terms and conditions on which new Brent would be traded, as well as the sort of some technical issues regarding the cash Brent, or some probably better call it forward Brent, as well as Dated.
All right, Kurt, well, why don't I come to you? You know, what was the latest Brent announcement on the 8th of June, and how is this proposal actually different from the earlier one published on the 14th of February?
Well, Platts announced that it would reflect cargoes of WTI Midland crude oil into its Dated Brent crude oil benchmark. And that was, this is going to be the first time that crude oil outside the North Sea region is going to be taken into consideration. They will do that from the June 2023 contract, and they will maintain the assessment on a FOB basis. So they will net back delivered barrels to an FOB number. Interestingly, that means that the assessment will start in February of 2023. So essentially, we're 6 months away. What's new about the proposal, and Addy alluded to it earlier, was that the freight adjustment factor that is going to be applied to WTI Midland will be 80% instead of 40%, and the 80% will be in line with the freight adjustment factor of the other BFOET grades. This is an important point simply because if you have such a difference in percentages on the FAF, as we call it, you might create some divergence between the Dated Brent and the forward Brent contract, rendering some of the other instruments that are traded in the Brent complex irrelevant.
Okay, so Addy, if I could come back to you, because you mentioned general terms and conditions earlier, and all GTs and Cs earlier. So the question is, will the current SUCO GTs and Cs be amended to reflect the current proposal?
David, the Shell has actually already done that. They've amended the famous SUCO GTNCs on base of which Brent has been trading for quite some time, as the name would say, since 1990s with various amendments. And it's really the dominant one. Probably for general readership and listeners, I would just add that GTNCs, or general terms and conditions, are basically conditions of the contract that make a trading a lot easier. So they specify a number of points that then traders don't have to focus on. For example, payment terms, loading days, laycan, law, so on and so forth, all these sort of minor issues. And when the two traders are discussing, they can focus on price and have a default general terms and conditions to agree on without going into minute detail. So Shell is so far has been the only one, the only company that actually did amend the general terms and conditions, SUCO 1990, to reflect the inclusion of WTI in the Brent contract. And it's actually available on their website with our paper actually having a reference to it, of course. They've done quite a bit in there. First of all, they've spelled out more detailed specifications of WT Midland, because we can come back to this, but sort of quality is still a little bit of concern in the marketplace. Secondly, they've also listed even eligible terminals in their conditions, which is quite interesting, and it's all very closely linked to the quality. Now, there is one big but. The Platts original proposal for forward Brent was that it would, both data and forward Brent would actually be remain FOB contracts. But for whatever reasons, Shell decided to have a CIF delivery provision for WT Midland, where risk and title of the crude oil passes from seller to buyer immediately as the vessel carrying the crude leaves the economic exclusion zone of the United States. I say this second part of the sentence on purpose because even most people would know that CIF is also, CIF delivery terms also have title passing at the from seller to buyer, the load port. So this is very interesting. And now we were kicking around the idea why that's the case. And we think there are two reasons for that. That's number one, tax. Number two, legal issues. And we briefly mentioned, and you would probably remember this, David, the Transnor case in 1990, where Transnor did not, it's a small trading company that did not perform in the 15-day market. So they actually took oil majors involved in the Brent market to court. And actually, surprisingly, U.S. federal judge ruled that Transnor could actually pursue that claim because, quote, because the Brent market was primarily United States futures market. Now, this case was actually settled out of court. So it was never really cleared up, the sort of legal side of it. But tax remains really, really important as well, because as long as you have title passing from seller to buyer in the United States, obviously that sort of tax liability remains in the United States, and that's a worry for all the Brent players. So I think those are probably the main primary reasons. So now we have to see what happens next. It seems that Shell believes that it's very, very difficult to justify a move to FOB, and that would be a lot more liable to sort of US legal and tax regulation. It seems that some other players may not necessarily agree with that. So this is really the main thing that needs to be worked out before the sort of new Brent starts trading.
Okay, Eddie, thanks for that. Now, Kurt, you know, are there perhaps alternative GTCs being considered? Will common GTCs be agreed before the new Brent starts trading next year? And also, does it matter if the GTCs are not standardized prior to the June forward Brent being assessed in February 2023? What's the background on all of that?
Interestingly, there are two other alternative proposals that have been put forward into the market in maybe a little bit less formal manner than SUCO's proposed amendments. One comes from BP, and the other comes from Vitol, which is a trading house as opposed to a major principal in the marketplace. BP is not uncommon in the sense that often forward Brent market now is traded under SUCO GTNCs with some BP amendments. So it's natural that BP would come forward and propose some additional amendments to the changes that will occur in the forward market. Vitol looks like they've tried to kind of step in front of the dialogue, and they have taken the rump of the BP contract, and they flushed it out in a way that is very much in line with what we see from the Platts proposal. So we'll have to see which way it turns, but clearly there's some discussion with major participants in the forward market about which GGNCs will ultimately rule. Does it matter, the GTNCs? I think we would say that materially, if there's not a strong difference between SUCO, between BP, between Vitol, between someone else per se, it's not a huge matter. What would happen is that the price reporting agencies would need to determine if there was any kind of price implication when they were looking to assess the dated Brent market or the forward market. But I would say in practice, it would be, essential to agree to one common set of GTNCs over time. And it may take some time for the industry to get comfortable with which set is truly the reflective reflects the intent of the contract to begin with. I would add as a side note, a standardized Brent forward market contract would go a long way in terms of allowing ICE to use one set of contract in order to settle their Brent index. And the Brent index, as we know, is the basis upon which Brent futures are traded.
Actually, Ali, I'd like to come to you on that and the kind of the standardization of contracts with relation to the price reporting agencies, if I can. Because, is there a difference in payment terms between Brent, Forties, Oseberg, Ekofisk Control, that's the BFOET grades, and WTI Midland? And if there is, how would the price reporting agencies or PRAs deal with it, given they need to compare, like with like, in order to assess the benchmark price? How will that work then?
Well, David, thanks for pointing that out. I mean, we mentioned in the paper that sometimes it just happens that WTI, in particular WTI Midland or any U.S. crude delivered to Europe, does sometimes trade on 5 days upon delivery payment terms, 5 to 10 days depending whether it's outturn or CIF basis. Now, actually, if you work it out, because when you have to actually come to the common sort of denominator and compare like with like, BFOE grades have 30 days after payment terms. They're delivered in about 2 days to Rotterdam. So that's about 28 days after delivery, whereas WTI would be payable, let's say, 5 days after delivery. That means that in a way, financially, in terms of time value of money, WTI would be more expensive. And if you work it out, depending on the rate of interest you're using, it turns out to be somewhere between 20 and 30 cents per barrel, which is material. Now, we're just kind of flagging this. It's not always the rule, and we can get around this problem. But I think before we start trading, Kurt and I are suggesting that possibly the PRAs should come up with some standardized form that everyone, the whole market, knows exactly how they're going to adjust this if there is a difference in payment terms. So what we did suggest, as you know, David, the LIBOR is slowly going sort of out of use. And we've got this new SOFR. It doesn't roll off the tongue very well, like LIBOR. But it's quite. We suggested, for example, it's just an example. We say take on the day of the deal or the day of the assessment when the deal was done. You take the SOFR, which is actually published by at least one of the exchanges on a daily basis for a month forward. We know that what's difference in payment terms is about 25, 28 days. You multiply all of that and work it out, and you can actually make a very simple adjustment. What we do think is that in the long run, that WTI Midland cargoes that are offered into the window will almost certainly over time go with 30 days after BL payment terms as well. But until then, I think it's very important that PRAs make it absolutely clear that some adjustment should be made. Otherwise, we're not comparing like with the like.
Can I come back to you for a minute to talk about some kind of quality concerns around WTI Midland? Because being a kind of blended pipeline barrel, you know, my question is, can WTI Midland be exported from any US Gulf Coast terminal? And what specifications have there been suggested?
It's a very important point. I mean, ever since barrels have been exported from the US with the repeal of the export ban 2015, the market in Europe, the Atlantic Basin, where the marginal barrel trades, has tried to identify which crude oil stream is most appropriate from a refining perspective. And as we know, all crude oil streams are blends. And this is particularly true of pipeline barrels where you get oil from Naughty Donkeys, trucks, other pipelines, and it all gets kind of aggregated together and put in one common carrier. WTI Midland specifically has established itself as the U.S. crude oil export grade of choice because it has a consistently higher value than the barrels coming out of Cushing, Oklahoma, which is, of course, the location point for what we know is the WTI contract. So in order to deal with these quality issues, Platts has stipulated that any terminal that seeks approval to be an acceptable export facility must not receive barrels directly from Cushing. They need to receive barrels from pipelines that originate in the Permian Basin and give a greater likelihood that those quality of barrels will be more consistent with WTI Midland. In addition, those terminals need to publish a loading schedule just like is done in all the North Sea terminals that are currently part of the BFOET contract. As far as quality goes, Platts has set out or stipulated certain quality parameters in which the WTI Midland barrels need to meet in order to be considered essentially WTI Midland. Those measures are more stringent than the typical API percentage and sulfur content. And the reason that's the case is that when you're loading barrels at, say, Solomon Bow or Hound Point, it's commonly accepted by the industry that you would accept barrels of normal export quality. With the pipeline barrels, there needs to be tighter parameters. And in fact, some industry participants had suggested even tighter parameters than Platts has actually stipulated itself, to include things like organic chlorides and even a simulated distillation profile that essentially rules out the top and bottom ends of the crude. So essentially the crude oil has not been spiked by additional things that should really not be there in the first place.
Okay, Eddie, can I come back to you to ask a kind of about, you know, the origins of New Brent basket crudes, which of course come from United Kingdom, Norway, and United States now. Does that prevent, or do they prevent, a successful legal and fiscal integration of the contract?
You know, I think, David, we have to go back to the sort of roots of the sort of all these contracts and benchmarks that are being assessed. I think that the key to remember is that it's the role of PRAs not to impose things on the market, how the market should function. It's basically just to sort of set certain rules and parameters within which the assessment process will occur. Now, you know, Kurt and I are not legal experts here, and it really is for the sort of major oil companies and others to see what the sort of legal issues are regarding the sort of cash brand. But I think it's very, very important to note that from purely PRA's point of view, the fact that something may or may not end up, for example, cash brand may or may not end up as FOB or CIF contract, and whatever jurisdiction is involved there, and we know that they're actually Shell proposal is trying to get away from the US jurisdiction and stay with the English law and sort of European jurisdiction, that the assessment process should sort of try and be divorced from that. And there's absolutely no reason why we can't have the sort of the FOB assessment from that delivered price basis anyway, even if we end up with the CIF general terms and conditions. So I think that's the key, sort of one of the key messages that we had in this paper, was that we have to listen to the industry, and if the industry thinks that certain problems are so difficult they can't be overcome, we just basically have to work around it. And I think PRAs will probably have to work with the industry to come up with a successful assessment process, regardless whether cash ends up being on sort of with CIF GT&Cs or FOB GT&Cs.
Well, look, as we kind of near the end of this podcast, I always like to look forward, if I can, in the last question. So I'll only come to both of you if I can on this. You know, what do you see as the next steps in the WTI Midland inclusion debate? And Kurt, why don't I come to you first for your views on that?
Briefly, I would just like to point out that, you know, it's an evolving process. The GT&Cs and the forward Brent market is already been a 40 year process. It has changed dramatically during the course of the time that all of us have been in the industry, and I think it will continue to change. There's time available in order to decide what is the right course of action before things kick off, and the industry should and hopefully come together, as Addy has mentioned, to come up with some sort of standardized contract that we can trade.
Yeah, well, as you say, 40 years, it makes me feel old, because I remember actually trading Brent crude when it was introduced. But let's pass over that one quickly. Addy, what about your views on that?
I totally agree with Kurt. I think the key thing is to remember Brent started trading in very, very early in the 1980s, okay, 81, 82 really took off. And the GT&Cs that we use for Brent, let's not forget, are Sukhoi 9090 GT&Cs, which tells us that, you know, almost a decade we actually traded all sorts of different GT&Cs. Now, of course, today Brent is a lot more sophisticated. I think that the futures, as Kurt mentioned, are the key in terms of settlement. We have cash partials. They actually have to converge into cargo, and that cargo, you can't have half on one GT&Cs, half on the other. However, I think it's possible. I think the key thing in terms of next step is to get to the bottom of the nature now, when everybody comes back from holidays and nice beaches and everything else, everyone will be fresh, and sit down as the industry and decide whether this really CIF is the way to go, or we can still go as sort of BP and Vitol GT&Cs point out, we can still work with some sort of FOB cash contract. I think that's the key, because the cash contract will start trading as early as February next year for June cash. So that's very early. But once we do that, 100% agree with Kurt, I think it's going to be an evolutionary process. There's no reason why somebody can't trade, for example, certain volume. If you have similar GT&Cs, some volume on cash partials on one GT&C, some volume on the other, and at the end of the day, upon the convergence, say, look, why don't we just agree, why either take one or the other, as long as they're not materially different, and we don't think they will be. Eventually, there will be a GT&Cs that will prevail, and the whole system will work. So I think there is a bit of work to be done, but we see no reason for panic. As long as sort of we get this main issue of sort of a cash or forward partial sorted out.
Well, thank you guys, both of you, you know, very much for your time today. You know, I always enjoy our conversations, particularly about oil subjects. It's part of my kind of history, which I really enjoy. So thank you very much indeed for that. And of course, it builds on the messages from your paper, The Brent Benchmark, Where Do We Stand? That was published by the Institute at the end of July 2022. So I hope you've all enjoyed listening to this podcast. Thank you, and goodbye to everyone. And keep safe.
Thank you for listening to this podcast from the Oxford Institute for Energy Studies. You can find other podcasts, as well as all our written research, on our website at www.oxfordenergy.org. If you would like more details about our oil, gas, electricity or China programmes, then please contact us at information@oxfordenergy.org.